Hi, I'm Mary Glennis.
And I'm Arlene Engelhart. And you are listening to WMNF Tampa from a woman's point of view. We're so glad you're with us this morning. I'm sure that many of you are feeling as sad as we are over the events of the past few days. And we have to both think about the wonderful woman that was and also how we proceed from here. But before we do that, I do want to say a thank you to Patty Perkey for editing and to Stephen Jay for providing the recording service. And as we go forward, we have to remain positive.
How about you, Mary?
Well, yes, but you know that after one gets over the shock, the initial shock, and I guess it says a lot that we would have been so shocked, at least I was. Somehow I think I just associated her with being immortal, perhaps because she fought so hard and so long, and her whole life was a battle, always looking to equality and justice for all. But when I did hear the news, I was just in shock. You know, that remembering, I don't know what the right words are for Ruth Bader Ginsburg today. It would take a real poet to try and express those words. But I do know that every person listening to this show, man or woman, actually, really, you have to find your own words, because every one of our lives have been very positively affected by that woman's ideas, by her visions, and by her tireless work. And so particularly you women, if you appreciate having a credit card, if you appreciate being on jury duty, if you appreciate having the abilities to control your own finances and your own estate and fight for custody of your kids or whatever, you can thank that little small woman that should do 100 push-ups, because she was, we will not have another person like that in our lifetime. And so you find the right words, whether it's thanks, whether it's remembrance, but all I know is that we really need to stop and review her life before all the vitriol and the terrible fights that are going to go down for her replacement, because she was so extraordinary, and she operated out of a prism of law, and not just law, but constitutional law, and that was perceived actually as the skeleton, if you will, of a society, particularly a democratic society that wants to give equality and justice for all. And how she maneuvered that, how that actually, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, so many have said, you know, that you judge a person by their words or their deeds. Well, actually, with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you lived a process in which the words and the deeds became, for all of us, opportunities and hopes and visions that we never knew were even there. And she didn't just open doors. She exposed doors and asked, why on earth were they ever closed? And so she gave us the ability to see and to make paths. Past that will be necessary for our own lives. And so without further ado, two wonderful legal minds, first Jessica Mason Piccolo, and she's going to be talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Well, I am so happy to welcome back to the show our legal analyst extraordinaire, and who more would I and I hope the listeners want us to talk to than Jessica Mason Piccolo. She's the Vice President of Law and Courts for that terrific, terrific website, a news source, rewire.news. And so Jessica Mason Piccolo, on this very sad occasion, really, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Even under these circumstances, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, when I heard the news Friday night, you were the very first person I thought about calling. And I listened to your boom lawyer that I think you and your great and good colleague, Amana Gandhi, did that night, literally. And I thought you guys did a really good job, a totally understandably appropriate with the almost a numbing shock. And tell me, Jessica, don't you think it's strange, because we all knew she was in very bad shape.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I frankly don't know how she's managed to live this long and to be so powerful and, you know, coherent and everything. But when it happened, I felt like, no, that can't be. She's immortal. And so tell me, did you feel somewhat similar to that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that's exactly it. We all knew that Justice Ginsburg had been very ill. She was not a young woman, you know, she was 87 years old and had served almost 30 years on the Supreme Court, in addition to having an entire life and career before that. So, you know, the news of her death wasn't a surprise, but wow, was it a shock. I mean, you know, as a journalist, I am always sort of prepared for these moments because that's what I do. I work in the news, but there are some deaths that just hit different. And as a woman and as an attorney and as somebody who has really existed in justice and equality spaces for as long as I can remember, you know, this one hit very personally for me. My entire career is possible because of the work that Justice Ginsburg took on before her time in the Supreme Court even. And so, you know, the magnitude of the loss is really what's settling in now.
And you know, that I found actually that because she has fought the good fight for so long, and with such a creative imagination and integrity and just flat-out brilliance, that it somehow is as if she was a product of the universe. And it's almost as if in this time particularly, when we're suffering so many losses, and when, frankly, I think we're in a fight of our lives to save our democracy and any sense of law and justice and respect, it was almost as if the universe betrayed us by taking her. and as you, and I imagine so many other, particularly women lawyers, she was a huge effect on your careers, wasn't she?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, just to think back and give some context for your listeners, you know, it was 1970 when Justice Ginsburg was then just a professor at Rutgers and had been goaded into starting to take on cases challenging gender inequality by her fellow students, not even law students at the time, who were really energized within the women's rights movement that was happening at the time. And from there, the Women's Rights Project in the American Civil Liberties Union launched, and that is now one of their flagship operations. I mean, under the Women's Rights Project, Justice Ginsburg saw tremendous success as an attorney, but that legacy, that project that lives on and really still takes up all of the work that she has been doing is, I mean, it's really almost impossible to put our arms around the complete nature of her legacy. You know, individual careers are made possible, but also, you know, entire generations and lifetimes have been made possible by the work of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I mean, you know, women used to not be able to open lines of credit in their own name, and it was Ruth Bader Ginsburg's work that helped make that possible. That is opening doors of economic possibility for generations.
Yeah, and Jessica, you know, that I remember in your Boom Lawyer that both you and Imani were feeling so bad because with the terrible conditions we have going right now, where it's just chaos after chaos, that you didn't feel you'd have a chance to mourn. And so I have to talk to Jessica because it's not so much mourn, but to really illustrate just what an extraordinary career she had. And like you mentioned, Rutgers. And I'm thinking, you know, that, you know, she was doing, you know, the lectures you told about affecting students, et cetera, but also she was volunteering with some ACLU projects in Jersey particularly she was fighting for teachers who got pregnant when they were teachers and they lost their jobs. And so there, a good old, I guess, grade school friend of hers, Wolf, was with the ACLU. And so he started to direct cases for her. And then, boom, I mean, the ACLU argued, I mean, like 300 cases in that period when she was, you know, the head of the Women's Rights Project, which they formed with her in mind. And she personally won five of them on the Supreme Court. I mean, that is enormous, and I think the ironic thing to me, Jessica, is that here is this absolutely brilliant woman, just brilliant, and Tiny and the daughter of Russian Jewish immigrants. And she obviously had a really smart mom, you know, who so much wanted to go to college, but she graduated high school at 15, but then she can't afford to go to college, so she has to work in the garment industry to send her brother to Cornell. And so this influence that, you know, she has on her daughter. And so when Clinton actually appoints Ruth Bader Ginsburg to the Supreme Court, she mentions that and hopes that she's fulfilling the goals that she knew her mother could have achieved if she had had the opportunity. And then you go to Rutgers and you realize when she comes out, she's brilliant. But she said she had three strikes against her. She was a woman, she was married with children, and she was Jewish. And so she was only at Rutgers because she couldn't get a job someplace else. And so, you know, I think Jessica, going through her career, to me, the most amazing thing about her is that, you know, that some people have the capacity that no matter where they are, when they get the lemons, they make the lemonade. And she was a person that constantly learned, changed, and formulated opinions through the context of law, which she so loved, but she also realized both its power and limitations. And very few people can keep growing like that, who start out so brilliant and just leave these paths. And I think it's almost like you thought, when you look, it's almost like the fog has cleared, and you think, my word, she built a mountain.
I mean, that's an excellent way to put it. There are so many points. You know, I think one of the things that's really struck me is around the conversation around Justice Ginsburg's passing is the Republican rush to fill her nomination, and part of that really cuts against this legacy and her work of making women visible in all sorts of spaces. I mean, all of the things that you described, Justice Ginsburg had spoken to about her experience sort of having doors closed and really the need to persevere in that. The cases that she took were about challenging the ways that we view caregivers in public and private, and that as a thing, you know, as an idea that really lifts everybody, right? I mean, I think it is very compelling that some of her most successful early cases in challenging gender discrimination were on behalf of men who were caregivers, and really the work that goes into changing an entire perception in the law that women need to be protected, which is really what gets to, you know, this ingrained sense of bias in the anti, sort of in that gender discrimination space. So there's just, I mean, I think hopefully what we will have the opportunity to do, with politics aside, is really have the time to appreciate Justice Ginsburg's legacy for all that it is, and see the work carry forward too.
Yeah, and I think the amazing thing of it is that she really, I think part of it came from her exposure when she was doing a comparative study in Sweden because she couldn't get a job with a law firm.
Yeah.
Doing this comparative study in Sweden, she learned to speak Swedish, but then they're having a lot, you know, she's seeing a totally different society, and they're having a lot of changes with their society where they're recognizing that both parents are involved in raising the kids, they have daycare centers, they have all this, and so then she really becomes impressed when she reaches Feminist magazine, and the writer says, you know, it's just time we stop these stereotype roles, you know, the gender, you know, male, female, when the whole purpose of everybody who's alive is to be a human being. And she comes back with that. And so she takes on, and really carefully, I think, analyzes perhaps our worst burden we've had in this country and throughout the world, patriarchy, and the advantages that gives, particularly to the white-powered male. And she points out so carefully that this actually is an impediment to both men and women. And so when she realizes the degree of information she's going to have to somehow teach her fellow justices when she gets in the Supreme Court, I don't know if she deliberately or she just realized that was the better path to go, but she chose the discrimination against men because she realized that would be easier for them to relate to and understand. And I think not only was that drop-dead brilliant, but it actually attacks the heart of the beast, so to speak, at its real base.
Yeah, I mean, so much of it's really difficult, I think, for some folks to wrap their heads around the enormity of the challenge that Ruth Bader Ginsburg had in the early 70s, getting a all-male, largely all-white judiciary to buy into the ideas that she was putting forward. And they weren't ideas that were unique to hers. You know, I mean, you mentioned her time in Sweden. She had picked up on the lessons and the positions advocated by Pauli Murray, also, who was a Howard graduate or a Howard University graduate, a black queer woman who had really advanced arguments that gender discrimination is as insidious as racial discrimination. And Justice Ginsburg was so inspired and influenced by those arguments that she put Pauli Murray's name on the brief, and the ACLU sort of looked at her like, we don't do that, that's weird. And she said, no, I do that, it's absolutely appropriate. And even that is, you know, exhibiting a level of mentorship that I think is easy to overlook, but really significant in terms of changing both the law as a field of study, as a thing that wields power over people's lives, but also as a profession that actual human beings live and work in. You know, she changed the law for all of us, but then absolutely also the profession and the practice of the law as well. And those two things are really amazing. Like, we just don't have figures like that who really do that quite the same way.
Well, you know, you study her career, and she's enigmatic sometimes, because, you know, I think all of us kind of have stereotypes, really. You know, and when she was spending the time on the appeals court, you know, District of Columbia, where she's with Robert Bork and Scalia, and what, 85% of the cases that she was arguing or dealing with, she was agreeing with Bork. And I thought, how can that possibly be? I thought, and I realized, I thought, Mary, you're reading about RBG. I thought, try and adapt her method of openness and listening and putting this in a context of equal justice for everyone. And so then, but it's understandable when then Clinton has a chance to appoint a Supreme Court justice, you know, with her white retiring. That a lot of the feminists said, no, she's far too conservative. And so he said, what can I do? They don't want her, until he actually talks to her. And they got along famously. And I thought, yeah, you know, I think when you really go through her career, you realize what an extraordinary human being. But I think what should be underscored is the human being of that. That she really was a human, and that she listened, she learned. She had opinions, but she was looking at the bigger prize all the time. And I think it's right when they compare her to Thurgood Marshall, you know, that they opened totally new doors, and doors that most people didn't, they thought they were just way things are. That's just nature, you know. And I think that before we try and be so concerned about who's going to replace her and how it's going to be done, I think it would benefit all of us to really look and examine, because I think in a way her life and the way she deals with all the obstacles actually gives us a lot of ideas for our past.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the comparison with Thurgood Marshall is really important to talk about, because in her own career, Justice Ginsburg pushed back on that a little bit, because she recognized that both were very influential and such, you know, had such enormous roles, but she would say, you know, my colleague would have to worry about, you know, depending on where he was at in the country, if he could be out in a particular town after dark, right? The burdens that were on black men were still much worse than the burdens that were on Justice Ginsburg. So even when she's doing all of that work, she's still got the humility enough to, you know, sort of recognize those nuances, which I feel like is really lost in a lot of the conversations, in a lot of the political and legal conversations right now. But I think that, you know, that idea that you mentioned, Mary, of Justice Ginsburg offering us a model to look forward to, you know, I think her friendship with Justice Scalia caused a lot of consternation, but I think that it actually is a real testament testament to her intellect. She was famous for saying that it didn't make sense to her to argue positions that she couldn't get people to join on to. I mean, if you're doing the work of breaking down barriers of inequality, then that means at some point you're going to have to be bringing along people who do not agree with you. And that's a sticky and messy process. And I don't know that we're successful in doing that by simply shouting over the other side that they're wrong. I don't think we're successful when we you know, sort of accept that there are arguments have at face value have value if, you know, it's like questioning my humanity. But Justice Ginsburg would say, I think, that the answer is a lot of nuance in there. And you're right, her relationships with Justice Scalia and, you know, frankly, former President Bill Clinton, who's a complicated man. I think it speaks to that.
Yeah, and human beings are complicated. But back to Scalia, I mean, he obviously has a scintillating legal mind, but also, you know, a quality that I consider necessary for a human being really is a sense of humor. And let's face it, they both loved opera. And yeah. I think if you love opera, you can get your emotional sense suspended in a plot. And I suspect somewhere in that milieu, their two spirits could combine in a way that they could have a respect for each other that, you know, in spite of I, like you, would find some of his opinions just abhorrent. But still, I agree with you, Jessica. I think that's illustrative because I think in a society as big and eclectic as ours, we would expect to have very divergent theories and philosophies. And people are going to fight, hopefully, just verbally, and trying in a respectful way to convince or decide, see, you know, is there something here we can take bits and pieces from both of our sides and come up with something that's workable? And I think if we're going to have a democracy that works, we've got to have that.
I could not agree more. And I think the humor point is really important. Justice Ginsburg was quiet and reserved in a lot of her outward demeanor, but she reportedly liked boisterous company, and so that would fit with Justice Scalia most definitely. And frankly, her husband Marty had a pretty big personality as well. So, you know, just lots of detail there. And, you know, it's yeah, I think we see from the right in particular what happens when you are unable to have just conversation with your opposition and view them as human, you know. And hopefully we get through this political process and through this particular administration and some of that can start to reemerge.
Well, and I'm thinking, and again, we're talking to Jessica Mason Pico, and she is the legal analyst extraordinaire, and she's with Rewire.News, that if you're not familiar with that website, you really want to go there. You'll find some extraordinary writing and thinking, and it's very, very pertinent to people's lives, period. And you know, also, Jessica, which I find really so interesting, is her relationship with Justice O'Connor. O'Connor.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was so interesting that, you know, that there you have, when Ginsburg, you know, said how lonely she was when she kind of retired, but I thought it was so interesting when O'Connor judged the Mississippi case involving a nursing school. And she said that, you know, just because of discrimination, that a male could apply and be part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And she based that opinion on the work of Justice Ginsburg when she was, you know, with the civil rights, with the ACLU. And then when the Virginia Military Institute case came up, when then this time Ginsburg's on the Supreme Court, and I thought, wow, I thought, now, in a way, that's not playing it forward so much as it's rolling forward, you know, in a continuum. And it, once again, you have very divergent views, but how, if there is a respect, and I would say a real, not just respect for fellow human beings, but respect for laws as the kind of rough structures, if you will, that a society to remain civil, and I think to remain viable, must have, or else it becomes absolute chaos. And again, to me, I thought, you know, because I've been desperately looking for paths that we can follow, and I thought, this is an important path, too. And I thought, do we still have that majority? I mean, I have to hope we do, but that's why it was so important when I was listening to you and Imani and being so upset, as I am, too, about all this, the talk about rushing through, you know, her successor, et cetera. And I thought, we have to pause just a bit and really appreciate what an extraordinary hero we had in our lifetime, because we need to examine it so we can go forward to keep it going.
Yeah, and I don't know that we'll have an opportunity in, you know, sort of a really satisfying collective grief or memorial for Justice Ginsburg. I don't know that conservatives will allow the us as a collective to have that moment. So we'll have to carve these times out as we can.
Well, I don't mean to sound like I'm totally Pollyannish, but I do know that, you know, she's going to have 2 days in the Supreme Court, and then mm-hmm. she's going to be in state in the Capitol. And yes, I have no doubt the rush to replace her. And perhaps, I know you're so busy, but if you have time, I'm going to bring you back then, and we will discuss some of the potential nominees and why they could be very seriously dangerous to all of us, but also the cases that are coming up in the Supreme Court, not the least of which is the Affordable Care Act. And then also really soon about the judgment on methotrexate, whether it's still they have to show up in
prison.
I mean, these kind of issues are right there, right on the table now. And we don't really have the time for reflection, but I'm not sure right now we don't have to take some time, because at least I'm not in my lifetime going to see another warrior like that. I think we only have a few of these kind of people in any one generation, and we were so lucky to have had her so long and with her so vital, because she fought right up to the end. Anyway, Jessica, we've covered a lot, and maybe with all the business you have, that probably these are areas that you've already passed by, so to speak, but is there anything you wanted to say, Treasure? I really do.
Thank you so much for your support. That means everything. It really does.
Well, it's such erudite, intellectual, thoughtful writing and thinking, and that isn't common in our society. And so I'm hoping I can have you back soon, so we will discuss where we're going forward in a way that perhaps will be unfortunately way too realistic. But thank you so much, Jessica. I know how busy your schedule has been, and you're doing great work. I strongly recommend they go and they look particularly at the tribute. You've got so many articles, and here your podcast, Boom Lawyer, it's very good.
And we've got a bunch more coming up, too. There's a lot of stuff around Ginsburg's legacy and what this means moving forward to plan, so I appreciate it.
Okay, great. Jessica Mason Peekwell, thank you so much. You take care. Stay healthy, stay sane, and get down there and do some push-ups.
You too. Thanks, Mary, so much. We'll
you
talk soon.
You take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa. And today we're remembering Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And now we're going to go actually looking a little more about her experience and her time on the Supreme Court. And even more importantly, why have there been so very few women, not only on the Supreme Court, but considered for the Supreme Court? Is that a problem? Yes, yes it is. And so with that in mind, let's listen to Hannah Brenner Johnson. Well, I am so happy to welcome to the show Hannah Brenner Johnson. And she is the Vice Dean for Academic and Student Affairs and Associate Professor of Law at California Western School of Law in San Diego. And she is the co-author of a really very extraordinary book, shortlisted Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court. And she wrote that with her colleague, Renee Kanaki Jefferson. So, Hannah, welcome so much to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, I'm sorry I have not had a chance to read this book carefully. I just glanced it really quickly, and I really am hoping soon we can get back in the live air studio so I can have both you and your colleague in, and we have a dual phone portal so we can both talk, we can all three talk at once, because this is a very important book. Yeah. And Hannah, did I read it correctly at the end, after the book it was in print or went to the press? That Senator Grassley, who is still in the Judicial Committee, was the head of it for a while, said that actually women don't want to be on the Judicial Committee because it's too much work. Did I read that correctly?
You did. It's almost ludicrous, right? You have to verify that that was indeed what he said, but it's true. There are definitely still very pervasive discriminatory perspectives that are held about women, which obviously that sentiment could not be farther from the truth.
Well, and we've had the horrible news, although it isn't really unexpected, of the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I think that, and tell me, I am curious, because so many, including me, are really worried that with some of the nominations I've been reading about and some of the ones that are being considered, that there's a real possibility that some really important issues, not just abortion, but reproductive justice, equal pay, LGBTQ rights, could really have a significant rollback. Are you concerned about that?
Well, I think that to be a woman in this country and not be concerned about that, yes. In a word, yes, I am concerned. And I will say that, you know, although the death of Justice Ginsburg was not unexpected, as you said, it certainly did come as an incredible shock to so many of us. You know, here it was late Friday afternoon, the end of the week, sort of looking to relax over the weekend, and then it just felt like being punched in the gut when I heard the news about her passing. The work that she has done, both as a lawyer and then as a justice on the Supreme Court, advanced the position of women in this country in a positive way, in all of the ways and more that you mentioned. And so I think as we're contemplating who might be the next Supreme Court nominee, there is concern. I will say, though, in just to try and kind of take a little bit of a different approach, the Supreme Court does its work based on precedent. And so while a justice or a nominee may have a particular political persuasion or set of personal ideologies, does not necessarily mean that those ideologies will be ever present in their judicial decision making. And so you mentioned the book that my co-author and I wrote called Shortlisted, Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court. It's a book about women who actually didn't make it onto the court, but many of them were judges. And one of them in particular, a judge named Susie Sharp, was on the North Carolina Supreme Court. And Sharp was an admitted racist. She believed in segregation.
And you didn't think she was an admitted racist?
Yes, she was an admitted racist. But in her judicial opinions, she followed the law, and she talked about the, and she made decisions that did not reflect those racist views. And so I think it is entirely possible for a justice who serves on the Supreme Court to have their own personal views, but not necessarily use their position on the court as a way to push them forward.
And tell me, wasn't it Justice Brennan that was so influenced by his daughters and his wife, and so perhaps that also reflected a learning curve?
Absolutely. I will tell you that I had the incredible fortune to hear Justice Ginsburg speak in just January of this last year, and I sort of knew at the time that it probably would be the last and only opportunity for me to do that. She spoke at a national gathering of law professors in Washington, D.C. And at that meeting and in that talk, she talked about the influence of women on the court on one of her colleagues, Justice Rehnquist. and how she observed in him a shift over time in his perspective, just being in the conversation of women. And so I do think that for a lot of us, we are influenced by the people who are around us, and certainly the men on the court have perhaps understood the position of women a bit better because there have been women who they have worked with over the past few decades.
Yes, with that in mind. And you know, I've always had great respect, and I'm not a lawyer, but for the Supreme Court. And the reason you just stated is that I've always expected of them, because it is such a high honor. It's not just an honor, it's a very serious responsibility to what this nation really is, that they actually could put away their private views and kind of look upon those maybe as possibly flawed or not comprehensive. And they would try and be honest to the law as they interpret it, because, and I don't mean to get legal analysis here, but isn't that the value of law, so to speak, and particularly in this country, is that it's written in such a way as to have a certain precision, but not so precise to be subject to an awful lot of error. And so it's kind of in that gray area, if you will. And to me, that's what I've always expected, particularly of a Supreme Court justice, that they will be very respectful of the incident, of the individual aspects of the case they're deciding, but also with that in mind. And you're the lawyer, you're the professor. Do you see it that way? And do you think there is any chance now in really the political atmosphere, which it's foolish to say it doesn't become impacted, now, in other words, how do you see it?
So it's a really interesting comment that you've made. You know, when you think about our three branches of government, the judiciary is really supposed to be insulated from politics. It is, when I talk to my law students, I often talk to them about how the law can be kind of slow to change. And that, I think, is probably a good thing, because unlike other aspects of our political system and other branches of government, law is shaped based on precedent. And so the opinions that have been handed down by the Supreme Court in the past form the basis for, you know, for everything. And so precedent is important, and it allows for a sort of a slowness and a methodical approach to the evolution of law and policy. That's not to say that there aren't bad decisions or there aren't decisions that are overturned and changes that are made. But I think that anybody who has served as a judge in this country understands the importance of being very careful. And the judicial branch of government is not one that just shifts kind of like we see perhaps in the legislative branch, and judges to some extent are insulated or should be from that political process.
And I think that in a way, to me, that's kind of what Justice Ginsburg did, because of, I think, the kind of uniqueness of her background in so many ways, that she realized when she got to the court that she would have to kind of educate or familiarize the men of the court and the one other woman at that time, because when she came, Justice O'Connor was still there, to really the conditions of women and how they differed from men, and that they did need to keep this, to have this in consideration. And but tell me also, with that in mind, with Justice Ginsburg, to me, reading her bio and her extraordinary history, I think it was such a pivotal time in her life when she actually spent time in Sweden doing a comparative law review and saw how a totally different society could run. And I really feel that, and you would know much more than I do, that very much influenced her understanding that it wasn't just a matter of equality for women, but in order to have equality for women, you needed just as much equality from discrimination and prejudice, and so it's preconceived societal roles for men just as much as women. And that was the tack that she took, demonstrating that it worked both ways. To me, that was her brilliance.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, we're all influenced by experiences that we have. Certainly spending time observing other systems of justice can be really impactful, and may in fact have shaped the way that she developed her ideas. I want to go back to something that you mentioned a few moments ago about kind of educating, you know, the other justices on the court. There was a particular Supreme Court decision that she spoke about publicly after the oral arguments happened on the court. It was a case called Safford Unified School District versus Reading, and it was a case about a teenage girl who was strip searched in her middle school. She was holding on to some ibuprofen, which many teenage girls do, because of, you know, the biological reality of their lives. And Justice Ginsburg, in an interview after that case, said that none of the men on the court knew what it was like to be a 13-year-old girl. And to be subjected to a strip search during that time, you know, really is something that a woman, a young woman especially, experiences very differently from a man. And so just having a diversity of perspectives, whether we're talking about gender or race or ethnicity, is really, really important on the Supreme Court.
And isn't that the words written on the Supreme Court building, equal justice for all?
Yes.
Those
are incredible words.
they really are, and they're very powerful. But I'm also thinking that Justice Ginsburg was brilliant, absolutely brilliant, and her professors had to know that. And the status of her career, first at Harvard and then at Columbia, they were very aware of her brilliance. And yet she suffered terrible discrimination, so did Justice O'Connor. And luckily for Justice Ginsburg, at times in her life, she did have professors that would fight for her and mentor her. And a Columbia professor actually is the one that suggested her going to Sweden. But I wonder, and particularly going through your book, and as I said, I haven't had the time to really carefully read it because I think it's so important, there are so many brilliant women. And if they didn't have quite, you might say, they earned that respect of that professor. But if they didn't have that person that would fight for her, didn't have the kind of mentoring they needed, I really wonder how many brilliant women's minds that we have not been able to utilize, have not been able to take advantage of, because they were at the wrong place and the wrong time, and there was no one to really stand up for them and say, at least give her a chance.
Absolutely. I mean, the barriers and the obstacles that women like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Sandra Day O'Connor faced early in their career, I think for many of us would have just kept us, you know, in our quote place as a woman. And in fact, even though Justice Ginsburg did have wonderful mentors and role models and an incredibly supportive husband, you know, when she got to Harvard and she was one of only 9 women in her at Harvard, you know, the dean of that law school, you know, demanded to know, you know, why a woman should take a place of a man who could have been there instead. And so there was explicit sexism, explicit bias, and yet I think you're right. As if the stars aligned for some of these women. They had professors who supported them. They had spouses who helped them, so that they could go out and do the important work that they did. But for every woman who did achieve that kind of success because of the support that she had, I fear that we have lost a lot of women who didn't have access to those opportunities. We do write in the book a lot about the importance of mentoring, the importance of relationships, you know, law school deans and professors and other attorneys who really went to bat for a lot of the women who we wrote about who were shortlisted, never selected to the Supreme Court, but nonetheless still lived incredibly professional lives that were just really impressive in terms of what they accomplished.
Yes, that they were truly extraordinary. I mean, every single one of them. And I agree, it's almost like a woman has to be an A-plus absolutely superior student in order to get perhaps some of the same doors even considered to be open for a B or B minus guy. And I don't mean, and I'm not saying there aren't brilliant men. I'm not saying that. But that kind of bar, it just by the law of statistics, is you're going to lose genius that no country, no people can afford to lose. And again, I'm thinking about Justice Ginsburg and her uniqueness in that she's argued cases before the Supreme Court. In fact, she gets us with a revolution, so to speak, particularly of equality for all. It wasn't just for women, but particularly for women, that she argued those. And I kind of wonder, you know, because there she's in Jersey, and she's, I don't remember exactly what she was doing, but she volunteered to the ACLU to help school teachers because she got exposed to, you know, many of them that would lose their jobs and be fired if they became pregnant. And so then she had, a young kid. They were friends since they were children, and he was the charge of, I don't know what his national or Jersey ACLU, and he started sending cases to her. And then when they worked together, that they actually formed the Women's Rights Project at the ACLU. And again, that was very fortuitous, but it so easily could have been missed. I mean, the stars might have, as you say, aligned quite right. And thank goodness for all of us that they did. But I would see that through her career, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, I shudder to think what would have happened or how slow progress might have actually been, you know, but for the opportunities that were available to her, the ones that she seized on, the cases that she argued, and then ultimately the position that she landed on the U.S. Supreme Court. You know, she worked so incredibly hard. As I was chatting with one of the staff members in my office this morning about Justice Ginsburg, she said to me that women would not be where they are today without the intellect and resolve that Ruth Bader Ginsburg exhibited. And I think those words are so incredibly true.
Yeah, she was brilliant. She really was. I mean, and I was it at Columbia or was it at Harvard that she actually had the privilege of studying literature under Nabokov? And she said he taught them all, and particularly her, how to write. And she said that she realized that a word could be a visual demonstration. And, you know, I thought that was, like I'm thinking of her with the Shelby versus Holder. And, you know, she realized that racial discrimination and the measures that were in place to, you know, do that and had been doing it, they were being successful. And here, the rest of her colleagues were saying, oh, it's done, we're in a new era. And then she used a comparison that we all could totally relate to. You know, that's like being in the middle of a rainstorm and saying, oh, I'm not getting wet, so I don't need my umbrella. And but it was that kind of ability. And once again, because quite obviously this was, you know, because a lot of people have described her as shy, somewhat reticent. But perhaps when you're as brilliant as she is, you don't speak until you feel you've got something you really want to say. I don't know. But when I've listened to, you know, some of the words she has said, or mainly I've read them in transcripts, she is a very good writer and she's very powerful.
Absolutely. I was listening to a documentary over the weekend where they were interviewing some of the law clerks who worked for her throughout her career. And one of them spoke about how she spoke so slowly and that it was as if every word that she spoke, she chose carefully. And so words are incredibly powerful, to your point, and certainly the words that she wrote and the words that she spoke.
But also, again, particularly, as I say, just a brief review I did of your book. There were so many other women that I think if they had been given the kind of opportunity, and let's face it, with the Supreme Court, it's very important if you're in the courts of appeals and all those others, but the chances of us reading or being familiar with the, you know, the dissents or the briefs that, you know, support or whatever, are not very high. And I really truly wonder. And I think about, you know, the men, the colleagues that Ruth Bader Ginsburg had, and really not being aware of any kind of menstrual problems that a young girl or a woman might have.
Right.
And it's so familiar to all women. But also, you know, that I was impressed when she said the loneliest time she had on the court was after Justice O'Connor retired. And even though I thought, oh, because they had pretty different views on many things, and yet she said that was the loneliest time she had. And I thought, wow, as brilliant and precise and, you know, with a vision that RBG had, that really that bothered me, you know. And then with Clinton, or not Clinton, when President Obama said, well, I brought you two more. Are you happy? And she said, I'll be happy when there are nine. You know, and you know, that's true, because we are over 51% of the, you know, the population. And yet if you look at the statistics, you know, and not just the statistics regarding pay and daycare and all of that kind of stuff, but a far more serious statistic of the, like right now in the pandemic, the violence against women. It's a pandemic that's almost as serious, if not as serious, as the pandemic. And it's areas like that. And you realize that this is not an easy, safe world for women. And this country has really suffered because of the loss of those brilliant women minds that weren't, quote, as you said, shortlisted. And kind of that gives lip service that they were considering. But you had people like Justice Vincent and others that absolutely would not tolerate even considering a woman being on the Supreme Court. And that's kind of sobering.
It really is. And when you think about the history of our nation, and that over the course of that history, there have only been four women who have been nominated to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court, it is incredibly sobering. There have been extraordinarily well-qualified women dating back to the early 1930s who could have added a really important perspective to the Supreme Court, but because of the bias and the sexism and the discrimination, they were never given the opportunity to do so. So I do hope that in this next era, when a new voice is added to the court, that it does contribute to the diversity of this so important judicial body.
Well, Hannah Brenner Johnson, you and your colleague, Renee Kanaki. Is it Kanaki Jefferson? Am I
right? It is, yes. You've got it right, yep.
I thought so, but I was hoping so. Anyway, and the book is shortlisted, Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court. I want to bring both of you in.
We probably should have, who have truly lived in the shadows, and we would welcome the opportunity to be on your show at some point in the future. So thank you.
Thank you, because we need to know the reason they were kept in the shadows. Because I'm afraid those reasons still exist today, and they have got to be gone. So, again, Hannah, thank you so much, Hannah Brenner Johnson. You do take care, okay?
Such a pleasure. Enjoy your day. Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa. This is From a Woman's Point of View. I'm Arlene Engelhardt. And you have been listening to Mary Glennie as she has interviewed two brilliant attorneys, and they've shared thoughts on Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And so, as we go forward, Mary?
Well, I would suggest that you read some of her writing, some of her dissents, and some of her majority opinions, and listen to her words. That, you know, the alchemist tried through the centuries to take some kind of metal and make gold. Well, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, with her brilliant vision, she created a mountain. But a mountain not of gold, but of opportunities and hopes and visions that we didn't even know existed. And so find your own words for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I'm saying thanks. But thanks not so much in awe, but in reverence.